The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericahealth.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management. Do you sometimes feel overwhelmed by life's difficulties or a traumatic experience? You are not alone. Welcome to Inspired Journeys, Overcoming Adversity and Thriving with Lisa Ference. Today, you'll hear from professionals and everyday people who understand the impact of life's challenges and the personal growth and newfound meaning that can come from the healing journey. Listen, pay it forward, and your life could change too. Now, here is your host, Lisa Ference.
Welcome. I'm Lisa Ference, and this is Inspired Journeys, Overcoming Adversity and Thriving. I'm delighted that you've joined us today. We're going to be talking about the very debilitating nature of shame. And as I know you're aware, it can be such a powerful and common emotion that many people struggle with. And more importantly, we're going to talk about how to overcome feelings of shame. My guest for today is a dear friend and a colleague whom I greatly admire, Dr. Janina Fisher. Let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Fisher. She's an instructor at the Trauma Center, which is a clinic and research center founded by Bessel van der Kolk. She's known for her expertise in treating trauma and dissociation from a somatic perspective, so that means working with the body. She is assistant director of the Sensory Motor Psychotherapy Institute, the past president of the New England Society for the Treatment of Trauma and Dissociation, an EMDR International Association consultant, and a former instructor at Harvard Medical School. So she does not have a lot of free time on her hands, which makes me even more delighted that she can join us today. She's authored a number of articles on trauma treatment. She lectures nationally and internationally on the integration of the neurobiological research and body-oriented psychotherapy into traditional therapy modalities. She is currently completing a book, and I know that in July she's going to be starting a second book, which I'm very excited about. Janina, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Lisa. It's so nice to be here, and actually a pleasure to talk about shame, as strange as that might sound.
Right. that is an interesting beginning. You're right. So, but you know, I know where you're coming from, because it is such a common and important and debilitating emotion. And frankly, I don't think we talk about it enough. So
Right.
So let's begin. Let me just invite you to explain to our listeners what we mean by shame as an emotion.
Well, you know, we're all so familiar with it, but we don't often talk about what we mean when we use that word shame. I think for most of us, shame is very physical. Something happens, whether it's some way that someone else behaves, a thought in our own heads, and we feel this kind of almost like somebody kicked us in the stomach. And usually there is a lot of painful emotion, and we just want to curl up into a little ball and disappear. When for many, many individuals, shame triggered by our own thoughts and feelings becomes a burden that is struggled with every single day, right? So negative beliefs about ourselves, or returning intrusive memories like, oh, I'm thinking of that again. I can't believe I said that. I can't believe I did that. So that we're tortured by the shame rather than it being a healthy message that says, oh, shouldn't have parked in front of that fire hydrant. Don't want to do that again. I don't like being yelled at by policemen. Right? So there's healthy shame. that gets us to find a legal parking place the next time. But then there is this toxic shame that is really, really, as you say, debilitating. That's a wonderful word for it.
Mm. It's interesting to me that you're already making this distinction that shame could potentially be a, quote, useful emotion for us. So you're making a distinction between shame where I get we could learn something versus shame that, as you say, is toxic shame.
Right. And, you know, this is the new neurobiological thinking about shame in the mental health field, that shame is actually intended by evolution to give us just a little hit, or just a little upsurge of shame, just enough to get our attention so that we can modify some behavior that we're not going to be happy repeating. And in the literature, child development and shame, we see shame being very, very useful for toddlers. So that when mom says, "Don't touch that, honey," the toddler sort of has that moment of freezing and looking down and inhibiting whatever it was he or she wasn't supposed to do. But in healthy attachment, the mom then says, "Good for you. I'm so proud of you. You didn't touch that hot stove. You come here. Let me give you a hug. What a great kid you are." So if that shame gets repaired in the attachment relationships, it just becomes a useful emotion when we need it to inhibit something we shouldn't do.
So I'm hearing a couple of important things there, Gina. First, I'm hearing the idea that you're making a distinction between perseverating or getting stuck kind of in that loop of experiencing and then re-experiencing the thing that caused shame versus using shame, I don't know, in a proactive kind of way to learn something, to, as you say, to change your behavior for the better. So that seems like an important distinction, perseverating versus being proactive with it.
Yes. And we think that the difference between being able to use shame in a very adaptive way and being tormented by shame is how it is treated in our early attachment relationships. So that if we have the kind of parents who say, "Good for you, nice job, you held my hand all the way across the street, you stopped at the curb, you didn't touch the stove, you didn't throw that toy, hug, hug, kiss, kiss," then we develop the, think of it as kind of the muscle memory for shame as a useful emotion rather than an emotion with which we are stuck and which is painful and overwhelming.
Now, when you talk about shame and you work with clients who come in with that emotion, do you distinguish it from feelings of guilt or other? I mean, do you see that as synonymous or do you see that as different?
I think there's a difference, don't you?
I do. Yeah. I'm curious about your take on it.
Yeah. So some very wise person I heard speak many years ago gave me a wonderful definition of guilt, which I've used with my clients ever since. She said, "Guilt is about breaking the rules, right? I did something wrong. I broke the rules." As opposed to shame, which is, "I'm wrong. My being is wrong." So when my clients come in with guilt, I ask them, "What rule do you think you broke?" So there's a rule here. "Oh, I didn't call my mother. I didn't do that favor for my friend." Okay, so let's pause for a moment and figure out, what rule did you break? "Oh, I'm supposed to do what people want me to do." And then that allows them to start to study the rules and ask, is that a rule that I really want to live with? Mm-hmm. Or is that an old rule that is kind of in my body, but it's not a rule that's very adaptive for me anymore?
I love that question, or I love that connection you're making to it being a rule. And I'm so on the same page with you, because when I talk to my clients, I try to make that distinction when we talk about guilt versus shame, that guilt is what I did. Shame is who I am.
Right, right. And Judith Herman has a wonderful take on shame and trauma. She talks about shame as a survival defense that allows the child to please and comply with parental demands so as to maintain the attachment relationship.
Hmm.
And very, very interesting. So she says anxiety says, I'm going to be hurt. Shame says, I'm going to be rejected and abandoned.
Mm, which flies right in the face of that core need, which is to maintain connection.
Absolutely. And I think you and I both know that for children, actually, abandonment is more terrifying than abuse.
Yeah. In your experience, at what age do we become aware of the feeling of shame? Has that been researched or studied in terms of, how young are we when that emotion finds its way onto our body?
Yes, it's very, very interesting. Shame does not appear in the first year of life, right? Babies are free of shame, which is very nice. It appears as children are beginning to walk and explore the environment. Mm-hmm. So you can see why the neurobiologists are looking at shame as an inhibitor needed by the toddler to make sure that all this excited exploration doesn't end with some disaster.
Right.
Right.
That makes sense.
Yes, it does. And especially if we think back to the days of the cavemen and women, where it was so important not to lose little toddling babies in a very dangerous environment.
So does that fit with Eric Erickson's stages, where he talks about autonomy versus shame and doubt? Is that around the same age where that's kicking in?
Yep, absolutely. And it's that same idea that if children get that repair of the shame, because I've yet to meet a toddler who didn't need somebody to say, no, don't do that.
Right.
So if we think that autonomy versus shame and doubt, well, the feeling of autonomy comes when someone says, good job, you didn't do that. I'm so proud of you. Mm-hmm. And so it's very obviously for those of our listeners who suffer from shame in its debilitating and painful presentation, that's really what we associated with trauma and emotional abuse or even availability, because the research is saying unless the parent repairs those experiences of shame, we're too little to process them. And so we start to, I think that's where the perseveration comes.
Yeah, that makes sense. So is the sort of the driving force about in terms of feeling shame, it sounds like that's very connected to interpersonal experiences.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. Certainly trauma, abuse, neglect, both tend to be associated with shame. Certain cultures use shame-based child-rearing techniques as just as a cultural norm. because it certainly is very immediate and very effective. Right? When we use shame as a disciplinary technique, other than the toddler examples I gave you.
Right. I'm thinking about John Gray's work from years ago when he made the distinction between raising children who are obedient, which I think you can accomplish by humiliating and shaming, versus children who are cooperative.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And we believe in the context of abuse, shame is actually part of the animal defense response of submission. So that it's not just an early warning system, but it's actually a life-saving system.
Fascinating reframe when you think about it.
Yeah.
So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will continue this conversation with Dr. Janina Fisher. So please stay with us. We will be right back.
Be sure to friend us on Facebook. You can do it right now. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America or search for us at keyword Voice America.
Overcome and transcend trauma with guidance from Lisa Ferrance, president and founder of the Institute for Advanced Psychotherapy Training and Education, and author of the book Treating Self-Destructive Behaviors and Trauma Survivors. Now in its third printing, Lisa Ferrance's book for clinicians offers creative treatment options, assessment tools, and new ways of understanding self-destructive behavior in trauma survivors. Trauma experts say,
Lisa Ferrance's book is a rare gift to clinicians.
Sound inventive approaches to help clients discover alternative ways to self-soothe.
And
far and away the best book written on this complex topic.
Order Lisa Ferrance's book online and receive a 20% discount by visiting www.lisaferrance.com. That's www.lisaferrance.com.
Your life, your health, your network. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
You're tuned into Inspired Journeys, overcoming adversity and thriving. To connect with Lisa Ferrance or her guest today, please call 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. Or send an email to lisa@lisaferrance.com. Now, back to Inspired Journeys.
Welcome back. I'm talking with Dr. Janina Fisher about the feelings of shame and how to overcome them. So, Janina, let's talk a little bit more about this connection that you alluded to before the break between traumatic experiences and shame. Talk to us a little bit more about that connection.
Absolutely. So let's think for a moment about traumatic environments in which children find themselves. And as you know, our definition of trauma has expanded over the years as more research has come to bear. Now we're finding that not only abuse has traumatic effects on children, but also neglect has traumatic effects. What we call frightened and frightening caregiving, parents who may not be abusive in the traditional sense, but they are frightened. They appear frightened, or they are frightening to the child. We know that being a witness to violence is traumatic. So research is really helping us to see that when we're very young, many things are traumatic which might not be traumatic for an adult. Now, in the context of trauma and childhood, then whether we're being raised in a neglectful environment in which we're ignored unless we annoy somebody, or in an abusive environment in which we're the target of rage or physical violence, Children need a healthy submission response. They can't flee, but even children who try quickly come back, as we know. Mm-hmm. They can't fight because until they reach puberty, they don't have the physical power to fight. Mm-hmm. It doesn't help too much to freeze other than to be seen and not heard. So children are really dependent on the animal defense of submission to survive environments of neglect, trauma, and violence. So what we see is that shame fuels the submission response. If you think about what happens in a submission response, we go limp, right? We flop.
Right.
Right. Our heads look down or away. All the energy, it's a little bit like pricking a balloon. We just lose all of our energy. Well, shame evokes very, very similar responses. Right, so we might first feel the painful emotion and tense up a little bit, but then we have this impulse to just hang the head and flop and disappear. So the theory that we're working with in the trauma field right now is that chronic shame responses actually reflect a child's valiant attempt to survive by submitting as quickly as possible, right? So if resistance increases the danger and submitting helps to minimize the danger, it doesn't prevent it, but it minimizes it, then the quicker the child's submission response comes online, the more quickly safety is maximized.
It totally makes sense.
That make sense?
Yeah, I mean, so if they're resisting and in any way fighting back, it's much more likely that that's going to exacerbate the perpetrator's rage.
Absolutely.
Just as you were talking, and I'm hoping that our listeners could, because I could really visualize, you know, what you were describing that happens on the body in terms of that collapse. And it just, you're right. It's a brilliant coping strategy. And then what I'm hearing you say is that it just gets sort of solidified and stuck on the body. And I'm imagining then that when perhaps it's no longer needed, it's still kind of the go-to body stance or response of someone who has that history of trauma. Is that fair to say?
Yes. And just to make it more complicated, we know that as we get older, you know, when children start talking at 1 to 2 years of age, but their ability to use language as a way to understand themselves tends to take a little bit longer. So we believe that initially they experience shame as a physiological response, mm-hmm. to which they later attach words like, I'm stupid, I'm a loser, there's something wrong with me, I make everyone mad, I make everyone treat me this way. And then those words in and of themselves can evoke the shame.
Yeah.
So, right, so our clients have a disappointment. Right? Somebody... they're looking forward to something, and they're disappointed. They make a mistake at work. They have an intrusive thought. You're going to screw that up. And the shame pops up as if they still needed to submit day in and day out.
Hmm. So the process that you just very eloquently described sounds like it's an internally based, internally mediated process, whether it's fueled by cognitions or sensory experience or emotion that pops up. In your experience, can a child or an adult ever be convinced to feel shame by someone else? So it's, in other words, more externally driven?
Well, certainly children in attachment relationships can be convinced to feel shame. Mm-hmm. That, right, because children don't have the cognitive capacity to say, hey, wait a minute, right? Who's the one at fault here?
Right.
Right? As we get older, we do have the perspective to say, okay, is that me? In fact, this happened to me today, Lisa. I had a client who's really in a pickle. He's managing to destroy a relationship with a woman that he loves very much. And today he was furious at me. He goes, you know, I ain't pay you this money to prevent me from doing stupid things.
Okay. Right. Was that in the initial client therapist contract?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. He said, I pay you for good advice. You should have told me never to pursue this relationship. And I was very aware that although it was uncomfortable, obviously, to have him so angry at me, I didn't feel shame.
Yeah.
Because, which I'm sure is what he's feeling, right? I'm screwing up yet another relationship. Right. Because that isn't something that is there to be evoked. Certainly, I would say 20 years ago, he could very well have evoked my sense of shame, and I would have taken full responsibility and probably tortured myself. But if we've worked through the way our minds and bodies hold shame from childhood experience, we're not going to be convinced to feel shame.
Go ahead.
If those shame responses are right there, right? And I was thinking about that image of childhood that you were having, yeah. Right? If I'm used to someone else's anger causing my mind and body to default to shame, it would have been a very agonizing conversation.
Yeah. What I think is so actually hopeful and optimistic about what you're saying, Janina, is that we can become impervious to someone else's attempts to make us feel shame if that no longer resonates with our core sense of self.
Right.
Right. If that no longer resonates with the tape that now plays in our head about who we are, that's an empowering thing, I think, to know, and certainly to teach our clients that, I was seeing a client this morning and we were having a conversation that had to do with her saying, my father makes me feel so ashamed. And, you know, just that notion of that another person makes me feel, it's helpful to reframe for adults that he can attempt to make you feel that shame, whether or not you kind of choose to take the tickets, get on the bus and take that trip, you know, is more in your power than you may realize.
Exactly. And really, when people say he made me, she made me feel diminished, ashamed, a little, that's the submission response.
Yeah.
Right? That's
yes.
Right there in the moment, that's the submission response.
Yeah.
Right?
Makes
because
sense.
I'm being told I'm a loser, therefore I'm a loser.
Yeah. And I mean, you are so expert at understanding this. I just want our listening audience to really hear this profound connection that you keep going back to between sort of our emotional repertoire and its connection to experiences on our body.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And this is really one of the new frontiers in the mental health world.
Yeah.
Is this idea that we hold so much of our experience, so much memory in our bodies. And my favorite example is if you go to a restaurant and you pick up a menu and you start, as you're reading through it, you say, oh, I wouldn't like that. Hmm, that sounds good. that's your body remembering what you like.
Right? Yeah. Yes.
Right. If you meet somebody and you have this sense of, oh, I'm going to like that person, that's body memory.
Yeah.
Or conversely, if you have an uneasy feeling, oh, I know this is going to be my new neighbor, but I'm not feeling so good about that. That's your body remembering people like this have been difficult for me in the past.
Yeah,
and all
sense.
Day long, we're relying on our body memory to tell us, is this good? Is this bad? Should I stay away? Should I approach it?
It's amazing. It's our whole sort of compass, right, for feeling safe or unsafe in the world.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. So in your experience, what happens to people's lives and to their relationships when they're stuck in that shame?
You know, it creates, shame creates a perceptual distortion.
Mm-hmm.
So what shame does, if you think about both the physical experience of shame and the belief system that goes with it, right, something's wrong with me. I'm not as smart, as attractive, as I don't belong the way other people belong. That becomes a lens that affects relationships, whether very close relationships or workplace relationships, so that we walk into that workplace, we meet this potential friend, we go home to family, already biased by the assumption, I don't belong, I'm not as important, I don't deserve to come first. All those kinds of beliefs have a very, very powerful, though usually not terribly conscious, power. Or to the extent that the beliefs are conscious, I'm imagining myself now walking into a new job, feeling I'm not as smart as other people here. I might be conscious of the belief, but I'm going to hear it as a truth, not as an old theory that helped me survive my childhood.
Yeah, and part of what you're saying there that I think is important, I know David Burns has done a lot of work with this, is that concept of emotional reasoning, that if I feel it, it must be true.
Exactly.
Right? And so often that's not the case.
Especially now that we have this understanding of body and emotional memory, I actually tell clients that their emotions are often a better guide to their past experience, and their perceptual awareness of the here and now is a better guide to what's happening now.
That's a very powerful distinction.
Yeah, and it really goes against what we've been telling clients.
Isn't that true?
We've been saying your emotions are who you really are.
Yeah.
But I think it's a better way to say it is your emotions tell you what you've been through.
Oh, Janina, I love that. That makes so much sense to me. Yeah.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah.
Very powerful reframe.
Yeah, and that's why if people have had very, very difficult lives, often their emotions are not their friends because the emotions are so painful or overwhelming.
And then as you're suggesting, I think there must be a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy when we walk through life with those expectations and we associate those assumptions and that sort of emotional flashback, if you will, with truthful or accurate information about now. Gosh, we're likely to misjudge so much and really make poor choices as a consequence.
Absolutely. And you're reminding me that years ago, I gave as a homework assignment to one of my clients who was tormented by this belief that she didn't belong, that she wasn't wanted. And that was certainly not the data that I was picking up from her description of her daily life. So I said to her, okay, your homework this week is to look around your world and look for evidence that you do belong instead of looking for evidence that you don't belong.
Mm-hmm.
And which is because anything that said you don't belong, she picked up on in a nanosecond.
Right. She had mastered that.
Exactly. And so she came back the next week and she said, wow, it's been quite a week. And she said, do you think everybody you know calling you for advice, does that count as evidence that you belong?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh, absolutely. And she said, and you know, at my church, I was asked to be a deacon. Do you think that means... And then I was asked to represent my church at the national conference. And she kept going on and on with this wonderful kind of, and does that mean you belong to? She had never, ever been able to see because she couldn't get outside that old shame-based belief. I don't belong. I shouldn't be here. I'm going to be rejected.
So let's take a quick break. I want to stay with this because that was such a wonderful example of a strategy that makes so much sense, even though I think for some therapists would almost be counterintuitive because a lot of folks are trained to then say to the client, all right, well, now go out in the world and see if you can find evidence that you really don't belong. Let's see if that's really true. And yet, as you said, they're so masterful at that, they can distort the evidence and come back with, you know, page upon page of reasons why.
Yeah.
So I love that you really flipped that and instead broadened her perception of herself and the world and invited her to look at her life through a much more optimistic lens, probably a much more enjoyable homework assignment for her, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
Right? To make a list of all the reasons why she doesn't belong. So we're going to take a very quick break. And when we come back, we will continue to talk about the other ways in which you work with the issue of shame. And then maybe you can share a couple of other success stories with us of people who've been able to overcome that feeling of shame in their life. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
Find out what's happening on the Voice America Talk Radio Network by keeping up with us on Twitter. You can find us at Voice America TRN. Overcome and transcend trauma with guidance from Lisa Ferrance, president and founder of the Institute for Advanced Psychotherapy Training and Education, and author of the book Treating Self-Destructive Behaviors and Trauma Survivors. Now in its third printing, Lisa Ferrance's book for clinicians offers creative treatment options, assessment tools, and new ways of understanding self-destructive behavior in trauma survivors. Trauma experts say,
Lisa Ferrance's book is a rare gift to clinicians.
Sound inventive approaches to help clients discover alternative ways to self-soothe and
far and away the best book written on this complex topic.
Order Lisa Ferrance's book online and receive a 20% discount by visiting www.lisaferrance.com. That's www.lisaferrance.com.
Opinions, options, answers. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
You're tuned into Inspired Journeys, Overcoming Adversity and Thriving. To connect with Lisa Ferrance or her guest today, please call 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. Or send an email to lisa@lisaferrance.com. Now, back to Inspired Journeys.
Welcome back. We're talking with Dr. Janina Fisher about shame and how to overcome feelings of shame. Janina, something that we mentioned when we went to break, which I think is really important for you to share with our listening audience, is the idea that shame can sometimes kick in when we don't necessarily expect that it would. So can you just address that briefly?
Absolutely. So we expect shame to kick in if we've done something embarrassing, if we've made a mistake, if we've been humiliated by somebody. But often shame comes as a surprise in when it's in response to something good happening. And very, very commonly, individuals with a history of trauma, neglect, attachment failure, experience shame when they feel happy, spontaneous, proud, successful, and all the things that, of course, every therapist wants their clients to feel, and, of course, what they've been longing to feel. It comes up a lot also with things like self-assertion. I've had many clients who've worked so hard to learn how to assert themselves in a healthy way. They do so, and then they're just overcome by shame. As we talk a little bit about strategies, I've learned when this happens, I've learned to ask, when you were a child, if you were happy, if you were laughing, if you had something that you were proud of, if you brought your drawing home from school and said, guess what, the teacher put it up on the blackboard, on the bulletin board, guess what, I got straight A's, or I got a part in the school play, how would your family have reacted? And universally, survivors of neglect and trauma say, I would have been laughed at. Oh, yeah, you? Right? Your teacher thought, you deserved A's? This picture was good? The picture would have been torn up. My father would have called the principal and said, no kid of his was going to be in some stupid school play. And then they start to see the connection. Oh, so when I was happy, when I was successful, I got shamed. And my body is still remembering that.
That's very powerful. So you're normalizing that it does make sense that even when they accomplish something wonderful, there's going to be this almost reflexive or learned response that you're connecting to being rooted in past rejection.
Yes. And past danger. Because when you displease your parents in an abusive family, that can be dangerous.
Yeah.
And that is something that, again, I often use the language of default setting because most of my clients these days know about computers and computer default settings. So you're defaulting to the wrong printer or the wrong whatever. and so if I explain these as default settings, oftentimes that makes sense.
So you're Look how savvy you are. Very good. I like the technological reference.
Well,
but you know,
I have a success story. This is the story of a gentleman who is about 60 who has suffered with almost, not quite, but almost incapacitating depression and shame since he was 30, so for the past 30 years. And when I asked him to describe what he meant by depression, he actually at first did not mention the shame piece, but when he was describing his depression, it really sounded more like chronic shame. He said, well, you know, I get up in the morning and I'm already convinced that I'm not going to do anything meaningful and productive. And then that sends me back to bed. And then I hate myself for going back to bed. And then I get up and I try to get something done, but everything I try to do, he rightly or wrongly works from home as a freelancer. Everything I try to do, I just have these intrusive thoughts. You're going to screw it up. You have screwed it up. It's not good enough. And so I asked him to notice that this was his automatic default setting. Mm-hmm. That whatever was going on, whether it was getting out of bed to making breakfast to getting a piece of work done to picking up the dry cleaning, his default setting was this automatic, intrusive, shame-based condemnation of himself. And I asked him if he'd be willing. This was a consultation, and often people take a consultation to heart even more than they would take to heart a regular therapy session. So I asked him to really monitor those thoughts, and every single time he started to have one of those thoughts, he would interrupt himself and say, that's just a default setting. Mm-hmm. Right? There's another default setting. Oh, there's another default setting. Oh, there's another default. And bless his heart, he actually did it, as you know. It can be hard when people are suffering to do homework.
Right.
Right? Because the whatever pain they're struggling with tends to take precedence. But he really, just in the first few weeks of working with this default setting idea, he was able to get significant relief. And then the key was interrupting the thoughts before they could have their emotional and physical effect.
Yes.
So that's a very important piece of working with shame, is separating the part of shame that has become some shame-based thought from the physiological, emotional experience of shame. Mm-hmm. And if I can help people to separate the belief and the physical sensation, usually we're halfway there. That's very key.
Good. So it's so corroborating for me to hear you talk about this, because it makes so much sense, and I'm hearing what you're doing, and I'm realizing, yeah, these are the strategies that I use, and you're right, they work, they're effective. You're helping the client also differentiate, I think, between then and now, right? Between emotional flashback and what's really going on in the present moment. And I don't know that we do that enough, but when we can encourage the client to make that distinction, and even to notice the difference that they feel on their body now versus how they felt then, I think that also can be empowering for them.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. So any other specific strategies that come to your mind that you find effective?
Well, another strategy certainly you can infer from this conversation is helping people to see how the shame saved their lives.
Good.
That had you tried to run away, and this is how I would ask, had you tried to run away, what would have happened?
Mm-hmm.
You had tried to cry for help, right? Or run to the telephone, what would have happened? If you had tried to fight back, what would have happened? When you went into shame and submission, how did that help you to survive?
Yeah.
And people get that.
Yeah.
Right? It sometimes can take a little while. I have to say, well, just think, what does the shame do for you or do to you? You know, when you're feeling the shame, do you look people straight in the eye, or do you hide your head? They say, well, I hide my head. Yes. And how did your father, mother do when you looked them straight in the eye? And how did they do when your head was down?
So you're really helping to reframe the shame as once upon a time being protective.
Right, exactly. And the way that I do that is to talk in terms of what helped you to survive. How did the depression help you to survive? How did the shame help you to survive?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think that's so critical, Janina, because I know that you see this all the time, as I do, that not only do clients sometimes come in with the feeling, the issue, the presenting problem that is debilitating, but then there's additional layers of self-recrimination. And so I'm sitting here thinking it's like they feel ashamed of their shame.
Exactly. Exactly. Right? Absolutely. Yeah. And so in that way, I think we can also say that shame is self-reinforcing.
Yeah.
And so if we didn't get that early repair, or we were parented by parents who depended on the shame. One of my clients says this a lot. She says, my abusers depended on my shame to make me compliant, to make me do whatever they wanted.
Yeah. So if you've got the shame and it's unresolved and it's unrequited, it makes sense then that you're also going to probably engage in a lot of self-destructive behaviors because it resonates to be punitive.
Right. And for example, addictive behavior, self-harm, self-destructive risk-taking all have the advantage of momentarily or in the short term reducing shame, right? So if you think about substance abuse, that's an easy way to get rid of the shame. The same with self-harm, the same with risk-taking. And then the difficult, there's another vicious circle because then there's the short-term relief followed by more shame. Oh, yes. What have I done now?
Yes.
And so that tends to also get into that same loop where you need more and more self-destructive behavior to make the shame go away. More and more shame arises because of the self-destructive behavior.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. Literally this morning when I was working with a client on issues of an eating disorder and excessive drinking, and she, to her great credit, had the insight that what fuels those behaviors is this deep-seated feeling of guilt and shame all the way back in childhood. And when she does those behaviors, just as you say, there's a temporary alleviation, and then she feels worse. And then there's more shame because she can't believe that she, you know, overdrank, or she's so angry that she restricted again. And it's a setup, obviously, to have to do it more. And what was so fascinating to see is that until we really talked through that cycle, she didn't realize it. She didn't realize how it fed on itself.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. And where it came from, I'm thinking of a client of mine who is one of my success stories, bless her heart, who came in with this belief, triggered by having been left by her husband for a younger woman. I'm too old, I'm too fat, and nobody will want me. And the more she was convinced of that belief, right? I'm too old and I'm too fat and no one will want me. Of course, the more she ate.
Yeah.
So it then became this very vicious circle in which she was very overweight, but really and truly those words made sense in the context of having been left for this younger woman 15 years earlier.
Yeah.
And what she and I did was we worked with a technique that comes from sensory motor psychotherapy called dropping the content, in which I teach clients when beliefs like this, these shame-inducing beliefs come up, to drop them the way they would drop a hot potato.
Good.
Right? So they imagine somebody putting a hot potato right in the palm of your hand. What would your hand do? And, of course, everybody says, drop it. So we worked with that and worked with it and worked with it till it almost became, it became fun. It became like a game.
Yeah. So forgive me because we're at the end of our hour and I don't want to drop your wisdom like a hot potato. I want to thank you so, so much for your generosity in coming on and sharing the work that you do. Is there a website or any contact information that you're wanting to give out for people to reach you? Go ahead, quickly.
Yes, so my website is www.janinafisher.com, JANINAFISHER.com.
Wonderful.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Nina. And thank you to all of our listeners. I know you have what it takes to take care of yourself, and I look forward to joining you again next week. Until then, be well.
Thank you for listening to Inspired Journeys, Overcoming Adversity and Thriving. Please join Lisa Ferrance again next Tuesday at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. May the next week be a positive, life-changing one for you. Overcome and transcend trauma with guidance from Lisa Ferrance, president and founder of the Institute for Advanced Psychotherapy Training and Education, and author of the book Treating Self-Destructive Behaviors in Trauma Survivors. Now in its third printing, Lisa Ferrance's book for clinicians offers creative treatment options, assessment tools, and new ways of understanding self-destructive behavior in trauma survivors. Trauma experts say,
Lisa Ferrance's book is a rare gift to clinicians.
Sound inventive approaches to help clients discover alternative ways to self-soothe and
far and away the best book written on this complex topic.
Order Lisa Ferrance's book online and receive a 20% discount by visiting www.lisaferrance.com. That's www.lisaferrance.com. Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericahealth.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.